Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, everyone. I'm Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. On Perpetual Chess, I have weekly conversations with the chess world's best players, promoters, and educators about their lives, careers, current projects, and best practices. Perpetual Chess is brought to you through the generosity of its Patreon and PayPal supporters. For more information, go to perpetualchesspod.com. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. We have a special treat for you guys this week. I think a lot of you will know who this guest is, of course. He is the five-time U.S. champion, 2007 FIDE World Cup winner, 1996 FIDE World Championship challenger, many, many other chess accolades, and, of course, of most interest today, he is an author of the brand-new book, Gata Komski, Chess Gamer, Volume 1, The Awakening. Gata Komski, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, man. Hello, everybody. It's nice to be here.
So this is quite an honor for me. I'm super excited to talk to you, and I got your book just in time, Gata. I want to give a shout out to U.S. Chess Sales. I had the book rushed to me and was able to tear through it in anticipation of this interview, and it's amazing. It's great. I mean, it's the chess itself is incredible, and you've got little memories from your career sprinkled in throughout. What was the process like of writing this book, Gata? Was it stuff that you reflect on a lot, or did it sort of bring up a lot of old memories that you hadn't thought of for a while?
Well, the idea of writing the book came to me like back in 2015 or 14, and I kept postponing the project because there were a lot of chess things involved. Still, I played some tournaments, but not at the highest level, of course. And I felt that since my gaming days at the chess top, they were basically over. You know, I'm 45 now, and these kids, they're all playing chess at the top. There are only several players of my age who still play there, like Topalov, Anand, and Kramnik just recently retired, and he was a year younger. Yeah. So I felt that it was probably time to share my knowledge, you know, with the youngsters, some of my experiences, trying to maybe teach them a thing or two about how this whole thing started. Because chess is a very individual sport, and for each player, each talent, each hopeful for the world championship title, you know, the way is completely different. What works for Bobby Fischer, for example, doesn't work for, Boris Spassky, et cetera, et cetera. You know, each came to the top via his own path, which he had to choose. So I felt it was time for me to write the book, but, I started to make some notes, but it didn't really work until I met my current wife. You know, she's a women's chess grandmaster, former junior world champion, Vera Nivolsina, and she was extremely supportive of this project. And finally, after searching briefly for some chess publishers who would be willing to work with me, you know, I never wrote anything before, and this was a massive project. And finally, I approached the guys at the Thinkers Publishing, and they were extremely supportive of me. In fact, working with them, and I'm still working with them on the volume 2 and possibly 3. And these guys are amazing. You know, they helped me with all the things outside of the pure chess, you know, with the editing and, you know, all that stuff, and even gave me some advice on the book and a lot of things. You know, originally the book was planned to be in one volume, but as I was writing it almost every day for a few hours, sometimes took me 5 or 6 hours, and, you know, the more you start writing, the more things come up from the recess of your memory, and a lot of things I have forgotten, you know, they came back to me, and I started to include them. So it's not only a book about my chess games, it's not only about my experiences at that moment, it's also about my life now, reflection on the past, since I'm a completely different person now, right? And I'm looking at them, and I'm comparing and evaluating what was there and what is now, and it's extremely, you know, very entertaining in a way, process, but it's also learning, self-learning, discovery. So a lot of things are involved, and that's how it started.
Okay, well, I've got a few follow-ups, of course. I mean, that was a lot of information to digest. I mean, first of all, I just want to say that I'm glad that you ended up with Thinkers Publishing. I mean, of course, I'm friendly with them, and, you know, Romain Edouard was on the show recently talking about his own great book. But it's a beautiful book. That's the main thing. And I often get books either through Forward Chess or on Chessable or even on Kindle, stuff like that. But I'm glad that I got the physical book in this case, because it's, you know, it's a really high quality book, and it's something to savor. But one thing I was curious about based on what you said was you made it sound like you went to some publishers and they didn't just immediately make you an offer you couldn't refuse. So did you actually have trouble finding a publisher, or did you just have trouble coming to terms?
Well, no, the trouble is that I have absolutely no experience in publishing, and I wasn't sure which publisher to get. And, you know, the problem was, it's like how we could connect and work together, because the book was originally scheduled for the early spring of last year, yes, and the book came late because I had tournaments and I was moving from Siberia to St. Petersburg and a lot of other things happened. So, you know, I was late with my book, with my project, and the publisher was very, very accommodating. He was extremely helpful and understanding. And again, it's not just about the finance terms, about the connection that you have with your publisher. I think that's extremely important, to have a great working, communicating relationship, just like in everything else in life, you know. And that was one very important moment that touched with me. And I said to my wife, I said to myself, hey, these are great people, and let's work with these guys. So the fact that my one book, that I was supposed to write one book, right, it turned out to be so huge that now we're like thinking it has to be 2 volumes, in fact, and at the very least. And, you know, it's a fascinating process, and I'm discovering this.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, it's no surprise to me, and probably to other people listening, that a work of your a book about your chess games is going to require more than one volume. And of course, it's nice that it has sort of the natural break of the period where you stopped playing chess, so that this volume 1 covers the games leading up to that period predominantly, and the forthcoming volume 2 will cover the subsequent games. And by the way, listeners, before we go any further, I should just mention the book is already available from Thinkers Publishing. In the United States, it's available at Chess for Less and U.S. Chess Sales, and it will be available on Amazon in a couple weeks, it looks like. So it's already out there for you guys to get. And of course, as always, I'll put links to where you can acquire this wonderful book. But Gata, let's get into the meat of the book. So you sit down to write this. You've had this rattling around in your head for a while, and you know that you're going to write it. Did you start chronologically? I know in the book you begin with when you came to the New York Open in 1989, somewhat legendary tournament. Was that where you began with your writing as well?
Well, I was. That's actually the point where I started writing, but because I still had a notable chess career here in the Soviet Union, right? And I was thinking whether to include that in the book. However, that would require me to get those early games. You know, in the old times when you didn't have computers, you had to actually write games on the score sheets, right? Uh-huh. And can you imagine all those kids' score sheets that I had to find and to get? And that was just simply impossible to do. I mean, my dad had some copies of that stuff, and I had some of that stuff, but I threw that stuff out because it was so old, and some of the experience were actually quite painful to remember. So I decided to focus more on the side when I came to the ES, because it was a clear-cut way to write the book, right? Because in the Soviet Union, again, there were quite a few memories, and I was a junior Soviet Union champion under 18, two times. And I think I mentioned it in my book as well, when I make annotations to my game versus Tivikov, I believe that should be in the volume 2. So we had some discussions with my publisher whether I should include this game, actually, because Tivikov, as we all know, he has been the world traveler, right?
Right.
And I know this guy since I played him actually a key game, the last round of the junior championship, which I won. And that game sort of made a big big decision on the outcome of our chess careers in the Soviet Union. Because I went up and Sergei stayed a little bit in the dark for a while, even though he's a great grandmaster, of course, and a great person. So, those years in the Soviet Union, and when I came to the United States a year later, there was no Soviet Union anymore. So there was Gorbachev, Perestroika, and then suddenly it's Russia, right? So those were like really crucial stuff that's happening, but I felt that it doesn't really belong in the book where I wanted to put my memorable chess games, where I wanted to actually share my chess experiences. And I felt that that stuff more actually belonged in the autobiography, which I'm still thinking to do at some point later in life.
That's an interesting tease. Okay.
Right. But right now I was more focusing on my chess achievements, some memorable chess games, and obviously I felt that I needed to include some stories, some experiences, so I can get the reader into my mindset of what I was feeling at the time and what it was like. So the reader, when he reads the book, he can sort of get a feeling like he's walking alongside me. He's experiencing all that stuff. So that was the point of my book. So that's why I started in the U.S., because, again, the U.S. in the 1989 when I arrived and the U.S. that it is now, I think it is somewhat different, somewhat two different time periods, and the country is different and the people are different, you know, different cultures, I can say. And, again, it's something to keep in mind. But back to the chess, yeah, I felt that that first tournament, you know, made a huge impression on me, because the differences were huge. I mean, the tournaments that I played in Russia and this first tournament in the U.S., New York Open, which, as you mentioned, is a legendary tournament. Unfortunately, it's been stopped many years ago. But and some of the modern players, I think they don't even know about this tournament, that it happened. It existed even.
Right, yeah.
So
yeah.
I thought it was a good time to refresh their memory, to make them be aware of some tournaments. I mean, everybody heard about the candidates in 1953, right, that Bronstein wrote,
yeah,
and all the other candidate tournaments and Avro tournaments. Everybody knows about them. But what about the lesser tournaments? You know, so that's one of the things that I also kept in mind in my book, to give the viewer some idea of what kind of chess exists in the world, not just the big top events, but also, you know, some smaller events which are still memorable.
Yeah. Well, I've got a follow-up about the New York Open, but first I've also got a few questions from supporters of the podcast. I kind of jokingly chastised them last week because I didn't have any questions, but of course for a guest of your stature, they came strong. So I've got a few questions to sprinkle in, and number one is from Peter Newhall. Thanks for the support, Peter. He asks, what audience is your book intended for, in your opinion? For your peers, for club players, for strong players like FMs trying to get better, or just to be a part of your legacy?
That's a difficult question. But when I started to write my book, I was trying to make it more accessible to players of all levels. The book that I was trying to model my book after was, of course, Bobby's memorable 60 games, right? I mean, that book was a classic. He gets straight to the point. He doesn't give much. He just goes straight to the game and gives you all those sometimes nifty psychological descriptions or explanations of why he did this or why he did that. And of course, the guy who co-wrote the book with him, Evans, I think, was it, or somebody
Larry
else?
Evans, yeah.
Yeah. They wrote those very nice, like small text before, or they gave the nicknames to each game. Yeah, the introductory names. So that was extremely interesting. So I was trying to model my book after that, so give a reader an idea of how the top mind works, but also at the same time to make those explanations more accessible. And in the variations that I tried to show, again, my idea was to show the reader the beauty of the chess in all its glory. That's why the games are included not just of a positional quality, you know, strategic quality where you move pieces around and then you go for a Rubinstein-like approach to trying to provoke weakness, then they go to the other flank, etc. But there are a lot of games which are tactical, you know, which feature a lot of beautiful geometrical motifs. Of course, since, as I mentioned in my book, I am a big fan of Lasker's psychological approach to chess. Psychology in chess always played a huge role for me, and that is why I try to impress on the reader how important this is, especially at the top level. I mean, everybody knows, like in boxing, psychology is like the first and key thing, right? But it also applies to chess. It also applies to other sports. So when I write my book, I try to keep in mind that this book is oriented for everybody, and especially for those starting youngsters. Like when I was reading Fischer's book, I was very young, you know, and when you're young, you have this huge imagination. You don't need the chessboard to actually follow the game because you can follow it in your head. And what you're doing is you're getting a pleasure out of reading the book, like it's a book, right? And at the same time, you go through those lines in your head and you get a certain a sense of aesthetics, you know, you get a sense of beauty. And that was my intent, to make this game, to open the chess as the game, following along the footsteps of the past greats, and to impress on the reader, you know, the things that I learned that I felt was important, but also, again, the sense of the beauty of the game. Like one of the movies that I always felt great about it was American Beauty, and there's this concept of beauty, right, that is discussed there. And that's what I wanted to achieve, you know, just to show people that chess can be beautiful, even if it is not flashy, if it is not like combinational stuff, but it could be little things, like little psychological trick here, little positional trick there, or the general setting of the general atmosphere, or even your opponent, which is a huge thing. It actually matters who the opponent is, right? It could be just somebody you never faced before, or it could be your enemy, for example, or it could be somebody you played many times before. All these little different things, they all matter. And I felt that, you know, in my book, I tried to bring as many diverse examples and the opponents as possible. So that was my idea. And hopefully every reader, no matter his age or sex or orientation, you know, they will get something and learn something from the book.
Yeah, and I, as I said, we're recording this Sunday. I got the book Friday, so I was kind of in a unique situation, but I did read the whole thing. And Peter, I'll just give you my perspective, which is that anyone can benefit from it. I mean, the analysis is no joke. So, you know, I'm rated around 2150. Obviously, people my level and significantly higher can learn from the chess, because you don't shy away from going into thickets of variations about like things that could have happened. And of course, something I want to talk about later, you're able to check it with engines now, which you couldn't at the time. But there's also enough observations and enough about psychology and stuff that even if you're not that strong a player, and even if you're not able to completely keep up with the analysis, the beauty of games collections is you're still able to pick up a few things and to gain perspective, as you say. And following up on gaining perspective, you mentioned being an advocate of Lasker's School of Psychology in Chess. Could you explain for our listeners who may not know as much about it what you mean by this?
Okay. It is kind of difficult to explain in a few words. But again, studying your former world champions in the past actually is the huge beneficial thing for modern chess players, especially younger chess players, because they can studying that history helps you with the future, right? Especially the chess battles. So Emanuel Lasker was the first to include the element of observation and of psychology in the game of chess. For example, he was often quoted on saying that a certain move, you look at the opponent and figure out his style of play. So, for example, a move that would win against Zbigniew Tarasz, right? It might be not that great when you face somebody like Frank Marshall, because the these two players are so different in the chess style. One is purely positional, strategical, and the other is creator of the Marshall attack in Spanish game. It was like purely combinatorial, even a little bit slyly, how to say this, very dubious, a gambler more like, style of play. So again, these little things, these little observations, they were the first to be used in chess, and they were used to a great success by Emanuel Lasker. Later this approach would be used many times. Like, for example, it would be expanded later years by Botvinnik, of course, and even then by Petrosian, who would use this theory to advance his own system of prophylaxis, which everybody knows, of course. And the famous Petrosian exchange sacrifices, those were not just beautiful and aesthetically pleasing, but they were quite valuable and practical tools. For example, suddenly you think you have an advantage, and then Petrosian sacrifices an exchange, blocks the entire position, and leaves you with a bad bishop, bad rook, for example, when his knight is untouchable, he's blocking everything, and you don't know what to do. So those concepts, they were new and very significant for progressing chess overall knowledge. So each world champion brought something new to the game. And studying those champions, especially the past champions, I think is very important for modern hopefuls for the world championship title.
Yeah, and hopefully even in this computer age, they still are willing to crack the books and do the work. So circling back to the New York Open just for a minute, I couldn't leave alone, because just for a somewhat casual chess player like me to read this book and to picture this 15-year-old kid who's made his way from Russia to the United States and sort of being thrown into this vortex at the New York Open with all of this attention, and then to play none other than former world champion Mikhail Tal in the early rounds. When you think back, and to win, like when you think back on the feeling, how did it feel to go through so much and achieve so much at a relatively young age?
Well, you know, just playing Mikhail Tal was one of the greatest moments in my life, actually. You know, it is a dream that I would never have been able to play him in Russia, of course, you know, in the same tournament. I'm not even talking playing a game with him. And here in New York Open, you know, where it's an open tournament, we have everybody playing, starting from 1,500 players, yeah, like to someone like Mikhail Tal. So it was an incredible feeling. And, of course, I knew Tal before because he was coaching Alexei Shirov, who was my, eternal competitor at that time, because we were only 2 years apart. And we're still playing each other these days. Right. I mean, I played him last year at the World Rapid and Blitz Championship. And it's so interesting because we started playing each other when we were kids, like in junior Russian tournaments. And now we're both, 40-something. Approaching 50, and we're still playing each other. Can you imagine the feeling?
Yeah, that's the beauty of chess. Yeah,
yeah, it's like we're no longer contenders or even enemies. You know, like we're never enemies, of course, but still,
rivals,
it's like more like
yeah.
your friends now, like right. your colleagues. Yeah, but yeah, I mean, playing Tal was one of those moments when I felt like it's amazing when you get to play one of the people you've only read in the books about. You know, the legendary Tal who changed the world literally. The whole concept of chess was his daring, attacking, sacrificial style of play. You know, he was a legendary figure, of course. And to play someone like that was, for me, phenomenal memory. So, as I mentioned in the book, when I played him, I felt like, you know, I had to do something spectacular. I couldn't just play normal chess, you know, to try to, you know, to be worthy of my opponent. So the game would turn out to be also quite full of psychological tricks. And in the end, I was very lucky because it was my only game and my only win. But as I mentioned, of course, Tal was slightly different. He was older and his health was not that great. But still, the image of him is like eternally printed in my mind.
Yeah, I can only imagine. Were you especially nervous for that game?
Of course. There's no explanation for that.
But you seem to have you worked your way through it. It didn't impact your play too much. It did
impact. Of course it did. Because normally I don't play that kind of chess, the ones that I played against him.
Yeah.
I even prepared for the game against him, which was very unusual for me at the time, because I tried to shy away from preparation and at all costs, which was my usual thing. If the reader goes along with the book and reads about my approach to chess, he will find that I was always trying to keep my game fresh and not to prepare, because in a way, I always felt that preparation is sort of cheating, because it should be two minds playing each other over the board and trying to prove to each other which mind is stronger. But when you prepare, it's like, you know, going to exam with your cheat sheet, right?
Yeah.
And yeah, so that was my approach. But again, chess is a unique profession because it combines the elements of science, of art, of sport. And it can be anything for anybody. It can be anything, whatever you want it to be. So that's a unique and a great element about chess. And yeah, as I mentioned in the book, there are many different styles that have been utilized by people to great success, right? And the funny thing is that the 1991 U.S. Championship, there was this opening ceremony. And the amazing remark by one of the distinguished people who were invited there, he said, with amazement in his voice, he said that recently it's been found that crazy people can play chess. Can you imagine?
That's great, yeah.
Yeah, and that actually struck me. That struck me, and I kept it in my memory because it is true, right?
Right, yeah. it might even be an advantage. It's not clear. That's great, though. So after this New York Open, of course, your story is far from done. And over the next few years, you're ascending the ladder. You're just getting stronger and stronger. And pretty soon, you know, still a teenager, you're playing Karpov and Kasparov and all these other legends. So what are your most cherished memories from that period and those early brushes with our chess heroes?
Well, cherished memories.
Well, yeah, I know that you had some interpersonal issue. I mean, you get in the book a little bit to some stuff away from the board that maybe made it less enjoyable. But I mean, to me, from my perspective, it's just the idea of sitting across from them and playing them is what I fixate on.
Right. Sure. I mean, of course, each of those encounters was the memory, it is a battle. There is no others word with that, because when I played other people, it was just a chess game. You know, we just sort of enjoyed the game and played each other, like, okay, made some preparation. Maybe I felt that this guy wants to win the game, but maybe he wants to beat me. He is a contender, but there were other factors involved. But when you play somebody like Karpov and Kasparov, you get this absolute feeling that you're sitting across an absolute power that wants to smash you to atoms, absolutely.
Right.
Or simply to destroy you, or to leave you absolutely, to smear you into a small spot on the chessboard. You get the sort of feeling, that killer, absolute killer instinct from each of those players. And the ambitious would be a too mild word, you know, to put when you compare these guys. So when you actually play them, you can feel this energy, you can feel this whole thing coming from them. Like, you know, and it's a unique feeling, of course. And a lot of people mentioned that in their stories, but to actually experience it is completely different, of course. So, but it's much easier when you're younger, because you don't think about such things. And you can feel it, but you say, okay, so I have nothing to lose, which is also important. When you're young and you have nothing to lose, then you can just play chess, right? But when you're older, you have other things to worry about, like family, kids. Of course, things are completely different. But when you're young, that's your advantage. it's just another lesson for you if you lose. And if you win, it's like sudden glory. You know, you beat this famous champion or something. So in a way, it goes both ways. So they want to beat this young upstart who seems to be cocky, who is gathering all this attention. You know, and I can understand that. You know, there is certain view on their side, right? But for me, again, nothing to lose and just play a great champion, learn something from that. And each game, each loss that I took, and I took a lot of losses from these guys. I beat Kasparov only once in a tournament game. I lost to him like so many times, I don't even know. Karpov I actually managed to beat quite a few times. And I lost to him lots of also many games. But to play them is to, each of them has a unique style, which is great, works for them. But they want to kill you in a different way, you know?
Right.
So that is quite memorable. When I was, slowly improving, and of course the critical period for me was when I started to improve really rapidly. It was actually when I started to believe in myself. And that happened during the candidates FIDE in 93. The interzonal happened in 93 in Biel. And, of course, we all know that there is the famous time also of the split when Gary split from FIDE and he created his own PCA, which created its own interzone, tried to create its own cycle. And, naturally, a lot of grandmasters played in both cycles, including me. But I was the only one who was lucky to get far enough in both cycles to actually present the danger for both of them. And the only difference was that FIDE, you know, it was less authoritarian organization, and it included a lot of people, so there was no way for them to put pressure on me. But in the PCA, basically, it was just all about Gary, and he could do whatever he wanted, so he applied pressure, and he, you know, including his lawyers, they tried to talk me into abandoning FIDE cycle just to focus on his own cycle. But again, how can you trust a guy who offers you to do this? Well, he can do this, and then the other day he can change his mind, and then remember what happened to Shiro, right?
Yeah.
So we didn't know about that at the time because that would be a later story, but at this time we could trust not this guy. So I stayed in the FIDE championship, and at the end we were correct because I got to play Karpov, but in the PCA, I was forced to play Anand right after my match with Salov, and I had 4 months to prepare while I only had 2 weeks to prepare, and that would seriously leave me angered at Kasparov because I felt that he handled this very strong-handedly, and he basically robbed me of my chance to play Anand on even terms and to, you know, to even set up a fight, because as the way match happened, I could not even fight him. He basically outclassed me in the opening preparation. 4 months is a huge time, and I could not match his preparation, and I lost that match. But if I had at least a month and a half to prepare, I would believe that my chances would be really good because I beat him in the FIDE, right? When I came from behind. So that memory, and there was another memory from the earlier time period, which, you know, first started to come to my mind with doubts about Gary's, honest claims. But okay, it's all in the past. But it's still something that taints my memory, and which still gives me negative reactions about Gary. Otherwise, yeah, of course, I always respected him as the greatest chess champion in the world, and about his chess, I could only say the greatest things. But apart from that, I didn't want to comment because personal experiences that I had when dealing with him, aside from chess, they were not great.
Okay. Well, thank you for saying as much as you did. I mean, and again, this is touched on in the book, but just like one follow up, if you don't mind, do you have a sense? So when this match with Anand for the PCA championship candidate cycle was scheduled, do you think that was sort of intentional by Kasparov in order to sort of stifle you, or do you think he just didn't care and he was just pursuing his own?
No, my feeling, and that was the feeling of some people, which I cannot name, of course, but at the time it was hope that Anand would bring a huge potential sponsor from India for his world championship match. I could bring no such money or sponsors. So the commercial aspect of the world championship match, and of course it's a huge thing because it's a crowning it's a crowning jewel, right, of the whole qualification series. So the world championship matches were always something that everybody looked forward to and dreamed of in their lives, because it's not just about the title but also about the money, because it has the greatest, absolute greatest prize fund of all and any chess tournaments in the world. The world championship match is one event where you can become rich overnight, but during the course of the match. Because once the match is over, you're almost guaranteed to pay at least $500,000, even if you lose the match.
Right. Yeah. Okay? Many multiples higher than any
and
other.
At that time, Gary, he was going for the corporate sponsors. I believe Intel was sponsoring him. But there were some already setbacks, and they were hoping for Anand's sponsors. Again, it is my opinion. I can be absolutely wrong. So a lot of things that I mentioned in my book, I said that I mentioned from my opinion. That's the way I view things. Sometimes the editors, they didn't agree with it, but they went along with it because they understood how strongly I felt about certain things. And again, I could be wrong in this explanation, but the fact that Gary wanted to play Anand more than me, that was absolutely clear in my mind. Okay. I mean, I was just a kid who could offer nothing, because who was behind me? I had no sponsors. The only sponsor that I had, and I'm very grateful to him, was in 1989, before my dad actually, fallen out with him, because he was afraid that he was going to start losing control over me. And so that's why he told me, he forbid me from seeing that sponsor again, James Kane from Bear Stearns on the Wall Street Company. It was a fantastic person, very kind, and he was into chess and other things. He was a great bridge player also. So again, I had nothing and nobody to support me. So, and Anand, he was, of course, a huge figure. And but then history shows that they played the match at the World Trade Center. And, of course, that's a phenomenal thing, because World Trade Center will forever be in every American mind, especially after the events of 9/11. Right? So, and there is no such thing as World Center anymore. So that event is like in history forever.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, thanks for being so forthcoming. I mean, that's incredible perspective. And obviously, I mean, if not, like, what better format for you to share, as you say, your opinions, I mean, your memories of what happened and what the motivations were for it, than your own book. So we're really, really grateful to get to read it and hear you talk about it. So one more question on the book, if you don't mind, Gada, from a supporter of the podcast, Chris Wainscott, and you already touched on this, but just to sort of finish it up, he says, Chris says, hi, Gada. First, let me say thanks for introducing me to pie in St. Louis. That pizza is amazing. My question is, do you plan on continuing to write more books? It seems like it would be a shame if you wrote only your best games collections.
Well, originally I was planning to write a book on London system, because everybody knows that...
People love you for your work on the London system. It's
And it's amazing. I mean, so many people quote me on the London system, and it seems to be one of the hottest selling items. And there are so many books on London system. They're so well organized and they're so well written. And I feel like, you know, these people spend so much effort in writing all these books, you know, and they actually quoting me, like a lot of my games in it, and they're thanking me. So I said, like, hey, I already did my part, so I why should write the book on the loan system? Everybody writes so well, and they already did it, and they did it in a great way. And I actually stopped following the London system. I stopped working on it, so no more updates from me, guys. So you have to go your own way now, find all those new things. But I'm really glad that it finally received the recognition. It's been played at the very top level for many years now. And I'm very happy that my small sort of role in developing one obscure opening into the chess theory has evolved, and it actually, you know, enriched chess. So I'm very grateful for that. And with regards to the other books, well, I don't think I'm a great author. I'm just wanted to share some of my insights, some of my experiences, some of my games, and I feel, you know, I don't think I'm such a great teacher. You know, I had some students, but very few of them actually made progress, which made me doubt my thing. Because, you know, you can be a great player, but to be a great teacher, you need that something very special, you know. Well, and not all great players have that.
That's
so
true.
I don't consider myself as a really great player, but, you know, I was lucky enough to be at the top level. So I consider it to be very lucky and to be a one-time top level and chess challenger again. So I still have some understanding of the game, but, you know, it's like it could be so specific and it's very difficult to transfer it to somebody else, you know, all this practical knowledge, because you have to experience it yourself in order to utilize it. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure if I'm going to write more books. I'll be really glad to make the ones that I write actually do count, and I'll be very grateful and thankful if people find these books useful and these books can teach them or show them or discover or let them discover something about chess that they didn't know before. And that's my goal. If I manage to at least one of those things, I'll be extremely happy, and I would feel that, you know, I shared that with the chess people, and you know, that would make me really happy.
Okay. Well, couple things I just want to throw in. Number one, there's a difference between you say maybe you feel like you're not the best teacher, at least based on the results of your student, but teaching and writing about chess can be sort of separate skill sets as well. So I was pretty impressed with your book and the writing itself I was impressed with. I mean, you've got like some nice turns of phrase in there. And of course, you're so well steeped in chess history that you're able to pull in quotes and perspective from your knowledge of previous world champions and stuff like that. So I can't speak to your ability as a teacher, but as a writer, I definitely enjoyed the work and wouldn't let any perceived lack of talent in writing dissuade me from writing if I were you. That's just my two cents.
Thank you, man.
You're welcome. And obviously an autobiography or something more chess related, I would be happy to see. Now, pivoting to a different topic, Gada, our listeners are always hungry to hear more about chess improvement. So I want to kick it off with a question from the mysterious and beloved supporter of Perpetual Chess, Mr. Moonmaster 9000. So Moonmaster asks, when you were developing from amateur to grandmaster, what training methods did you find most valuable and what training methods did you find least valuable?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You're a fan of the Moonmaster too?
I'm quite intrigued by this very mysterious Moonmaster.
Exactly.
That you mentioned. But about the chess improvement, I think my main chess improvement came so rapidly because of the one thing. I was just really young, and when you're young, you just catch things. You don't really necessarily, I wouldn't say that I necessarily studied chess, but I did follow famous Capablanca saying that you should study your lost games because they would give you more benefit than your won games. So definitely analyze and study your games in detail. So that's one incredible lesson. Definitely works. The second one is that for each player, each person is different. For a practical player who likes playing chess but he doesn't like to study chess, I would recommend something that I would do, and I'm still doing it a little bit, is you should play more tournaments, because it is much easier than to study your games that you just play than to look at certain opening and force yourself to look through the books or go through the databases. So when you play a tournament, you just play a game, you come home, you analyze your game, and basically you're forced to look at a certain line anyway, right?
Right.
So that seems to be an easy approach. So I'm a big fan of this easy easy study approach. Because studying all those books, I always hated it, to be honest. My father, when I was young, he would give me this huge stack of chess books, and he'd tell me you should study all of them. Of course, you know, I didn't know then that when I was younger, he was just joking. Obviously, he didn't expect me to go through all those books, but I felt like, hey, I have to go through all those books. So I would shuffle the books, and I would read some kid book, and I would shuffle the books, and it would look like, you know, I went through all those books, and my dad would come home, and he would ask me, like, did you go through all those books? I said, yeah, with a serious face, you know. And I wouldn't realize, of course, he knew that I was lying, because it was very obvious, but but some things like that, you know, do actually not work. So, the best, my advice is, would be to do this. This is what also Karpov did. So you play a lot of tournaments, you study your games, and the other thing, of course, as I mentioned, when you're younger, you pick up things faster. It's like languages, right?
Yeah.
What else? I mean, you can improve in chess, always improve in chess, but just when you're older, it takes longer. And there are other things, you know, that take your time. Because, when you're younger, you can do chess, and that's basically all your – and if you're in school, you do school, right?
Right.
So, but that's basically all that you have to do in life at that moment, and you're carefree. You don't worry about it because your parents take care of everything. That's why there's this famous saying by Russian Grandmaster Kalachman, right? He says that if you're married, then forget about the world championship title, right? That is like a famous joke in Russia. Because you get other things, you cannot do chess anymore, you cannot focus on them solely, and there was always a huge dispute about that. Because if you want to be world champion, then you gotta be like Bobby. You have to be crazy about chess, you have to do them like 24/7, 7 days a week, etc. And of course, now you have to be, because chess got a lot faster, you have faster time controls, you know, it's more like sport now. A lot of people like to, you know, catch you in the computer analysis, so you have to practice your tactics, you have to be aware of the strategic moments, you have to know a lot of openings, because in the computer age era, again, you can study with the computer basically any opening line, and even if it is considered dubious, you can always find something, some line which is not well known or well played, and the computer will show you that there is not so simple to prove an advantage for white or inequality for black either. So basically, you have to be prepared for any opening. You have to be prepared for any nasty computer surprise there where computer knows all the next 15, 20 moves. So it's very hard to talk about improvement because there are several goals. Do you want to win the tournament or you want to improve your chess overall? And these could be completely different things.
Yeah, it can be hard to have the big picture in mind when you just have the next game right in front of you. Well, that's great advice. One thing I wanted to follow up on was you mentioned the pile of books that your dad would leave you with. And of course, the amount of chess books you read as a young star chess player is sort of the stuff of legend. So it's surprising to hear you say that you didn't read a lot of those books. So my question for you, Gata, is when you were in your room and your dad thought you were reading those books, what were you actually doing?
I was reading kids' books. My dad had a huge library of books. You know, thankfully, he was a big fan of all those philosophies. So I was reading anything from kids' book to some romance by French romantic. And then I was reading some philosophy on Eastern philosophies and anything but chess, really.
Huh.
Of course, I had to still to do some chess stuff. I mean, he would give me, when I went to school, he would give me a chess study, like by Kasparian or by Kubel. Those are really famous. And actually, I owe them a lot in my endgame understanding. So one of the basics in chess you have to know absolutely is how to play the endgames. So that I completely agree with. And the best way to study those games is actually to study those famous composers and study endgame composers. So Kubel and Kasparian, they gave me the sense of beauty in chess. And they actually taught it to me. And so when I went to school, he would tell me, so you have five or four classes. You have 10, 15 minutes in between the classes. So what you do is you have to do three or four studies a day. And while all those kids, you know, they were having fun between the classes, you know, I would be forced to skip on all the socializing, you know, all this very important kid stuff, and I would have to do all those chess studies. And you know, there is a very conflicted feelings about that time period. In terms of chess, yes, those studies were important, but I felt like I missed a lot of good things as well.
Yeah.
Okay. But in terms of chess, studies are very good, especially end games. Because one of the things that I noticed in the present generation kids is that they're absolutely great in theory. They know all those complicated lines. They play computer moves. They can see tactics. And in the past they said that the strategy is the main thing and tactics should be based on the strategy, right? Well, this is all out of the window because now you cannot do a strategic plan if it falls apart in 2-3 combo, right? If there is a tactics which leaves your plan in ruins in 2-3 moves, there is nothing that you can do. And all the modern openings are based on a lot of tactics. A lot of lines are simply forced. But if you're able to survive all that, if you're able to survive into the end game where you're worse, but it is playable, then there is a pretty good chance that you can outplay any youngster because they simply don't know how to approach the end game. And that's where your knowledge, that's where you get all the chances how to beat these kids. So if you guys like older, you know, like, you know, mark this advice. So I'm telling you how to beat the youngsters. Mm-hmm. It could be really important. So bring them to the end game where your experience will help you beat them. Okay? So
yeah, that's great advice. I don't know how old Moonmaster 9000 is, but that's, yeah. Ben Feingold called it old man chess. Do you think that they're weaker positionally as well, or is it primarily end game, strictly end games?
Well, as I said, these days it's very difficult to say what is more important because, again, modern chess are all about the tactical possibilities and strategy. It seems now... It's really complicated to play strategic, pure strategic chess because the, the very concrete chess, right? It's the time period where every line, every move, you know, every tempo is extremely important and can be punished by your opponent. So, there are certain still strategic openings left, but, there are very few of those. And even if you play them, there are always some lines where everything can be forced, and you're forced to calculate tactically. So tactics, you should solve a lot of tactics because you need to be aware of that, and you need to calculate well. I mean, a lot of players, even at the top level, if you look at the recent tournaments, even top players, they make blunders, right? And suddenly the computer says the game is like 0-0-0-0 even, and then suddenly blunder, boom, and it's -5, -6, and you can resign, yeah? So, and it happens all the time. So tactical vision is extremely important. So, again, training your tactics is important.
Okay. Excellent advice. Do you feel, do you have a sense for... So you mentioned you weren't studying as much as it was presented to the outside world. Do you feel like you had a lot of talent at chess, or to what do you mainly attribute the success that you had?
Well, I would say that in chess, yes, actually, there is such thing as the natural gift. I mean, every person is good at something, right?
Right.
And what is specific about chess, again, as I mentioned, it is both art. It's not just both. It contains elements of everything, like art, again, sport and stuff. And because it contains elements of all those, there's pretty good chance that the person who's playing chess is pretty good at least one of those elements. Yeah. So I would say that that's why almost every person who plays chess is absolutely gifted. And if he has time and energy, right, and he's young, is you can basically make world champion out of anybody. If he's like, if the kid is 5 years old, right? He's a normal kid. And if you train him correctly, if you give him a whole band of coaches, like Kasparov had, right? Or like in Russia, he was the only one who had a huge team of helpers thanks to his connections, you know, to his mother, to his political connections, and et cetera, et cetera. All the rest of the kids in Russia, they never had a chance like that. If they had a chance like that, there would be so many Kasparovs you wouldn't believe. But he was the only one who actually had such a support, which is why he is Kasparov. He was also very early the only one who had access to the computers. And that also gave him a huge advantage. I mean, these days it's taken for granted that the opening preparation is based on a lot of computer assistance. But at that time, not many people knew about the computers, and the computers were considered to be not that strong. But if you had like 5 or 10 computers, you know, and they've been left analyzing overnight, and you had assistants working with the computers who knew how to work with the computers, like, for example, Roman Jinkhashvili, who introduced me to the this whole thing with computers, how to work with them, how to work with them correctly, to understand the, you know, to work with the computers correctly, you need to understand their weaknesses and their strong points. So he taught me how to work with the computers. And that was a huge opener for me, a huge discovery. I realized that I was missing a lot of things. So again, chess gives you an ability to reach a lot of things. You don't have to be talented, but basically you have an inner talent for something in any profession. But in chess, you have a lot of possibilities because it contains a lot of things from life. So,
Okay, great advice. And we've just got one more listener question, and then I just have a few more questions if you're up for it, Gada. This has been amazing. So the listener question, and this listener said he was looking forward to hearing me try to pronounce his name. So wish me luck here. Vyacheslav Nemec, he's Croatian, and my Croatian is non-existent, but hopefully I was in the ballpark, Vyacheslav. So he asks... in the history of chess, there have been many prodigies with great potential who didn't become top players. What do you think is the reason? And you just touched on this a little. And then he says, what can parents and chess trainers do to ensure a balance between being a chess professional and having a normal childhood at an early age?
Well, that's, again, a question that touches on a lot of things, and you can't really respond to it even for an hour if you try to. I will touch on again on the thing that the first part of the question. If you're a very talented kid and you have some coaches, but you didn't make it to the world championship title, I mean, let's. I don't want to make any offense, but let's, for example, take a look at Giri, right? Mm-hmm. We all know Giri.
Anish
Giri. He's been at the top level for many years, right? He's been playing. Vikanzi for many years. He had a lot of coaches, world-class coaches, right? He is still, I mean, he probably won some strong events. I just don't remember at the moment which ones he did. But he's still very strong grandmaster, right? He's at the very top, right there. But he still didn't make it to the candidates. Like he didn't make it to the world championship title, and he's had all the chances, right? I would say he still has many years, of course, ahead of him to try for it. So he may, but that's a perfect example of somebody who had a lot of coaches and who didn't make it to become a world champion. What is missing? That is a good question. So perhaps it's best to ask him what is missing, because I'm sure he knows the answer to that. How many other players who have such a huge team of helpers? There are not that many. I mean, it all has to be together. I know, for example, in the U.S. now, the Sinkfels, they've been pouring a lot of energy, their time into chess, and they created chess, and they created this wonderful absolute city of St. Louis, which is the capital of the chess in the United States, right? And they've been helping a lot Hikaru, they've been helping a lot Grana, and maybe even Wesley, with Wesley I'm not that sure, but I'm pretty sure that Grana and Hikaru, they received a lot of support from these guys. I didn't receive any support from them when I was a candidate, but okay, that's okay, because I was always considered a Russian in America, which was always made me very sad.
Oh.
Because I lived in the U.S. for 30 years and I still considered Russian. So even though I played for the Olympic team, I helped the U.S. Bring some Olympic medals, bronze medals, even gold medal in 93, etc. But still, but what can you do? You know, if you're born in one country, can you what can you do? Anyway, That's not the point. The point is how many actually kids they do get such a support. I mean, even these days, the way that Kasparov had support, I would say he had much greater support than Geary that we just talked about, right? And of course, a lot depends on the coach as well. For example, there were famous stories about Spassky, coach, I think it was Boleslavsky, and there were some legends about his impulsive nature. Because Spassky is more like a melancholic type of player. I mean, he was extremely talented, but it was claimed to be he was also extremely lazy. So his coach had to always push him to work harder. So there has to be that chemistry, you know, what I'm talking about. There has to be the correct chemistry. You have to have a correct coach. It's not just like any coach.
Right.
You have to find the right coach for you. The one that pushes you, the one that compliments you. It's not like if you're two of the same, it's not going to be the same as like if you compliment each other, right? There's that moment of synergy. So all those little details, they work. And that coach, he has to be really, really dedicated to make you a world champion. Basically, you're asking that coach to forget his professional approach. You're asking that coach to dedicate his entire life for you, right? The only, of course, other exception, of course, is Magnus Carlsen. I mean, that guy, he's a world champion, but why he is a world champion? I played that kid when he was very young. I played him first time in 2005 World Cup, and I also mentioned all that in my book, of course. And then I played him again in the World Cup of 2007. I eliminated him on both occasions, but there was a clear and obvious difference, you know, how the guy grew. He was extremely talented, and he was, you know, his playing strength was much different. He was much stronger in 2007 than he was in 2005. Still, that would not guarantee him the success in the future. I remember I had a discussion with him after one World Cup. I'm not sure which one it was, 2005, 2007. But I had a really big chat with him at the airport. And I felt that this kid had a huge potential. So I talked to him and I think I advised him on a few things. And the next thing you know, this guy, he is working with Kasparov, which I think is the absolute critical moment, which actually pushed him and made him the world champion. Because without that work with Geary, without all that insight, without all that dedication from Geary, without that energy, and he would never become the world champion. That to me is my purely humble opinion, but the one that I feel very strongly about it. So, you know, in order to become the best, you have to learn from the best. You have to learn, and it doesn't have to be merely chess. When you're in a contact with such person, you know, there's not always verbal stuff, right, that goes that you communicate, that you take. Sometimes it's certain traits of the character. Sometimes it's psychological things. Sometimes the attitude, you know, you learn all that stuff, you know, you copy some stuff, even subconsciously, right? And you learn and you add it to yourself and you become something greater than you were before. Anyway, so he learned a lot from him chess-wise. And he learned from him a lot of things, other things. And I feel that that was the critical missing element. And I'm not sure that, you know, all the other players, they can get that kind of level of dedication, because I know that Geary worked later with other kids, but there might be something missing. He wasn't probably working with a similar dedication that the one he worked with Magnus, you know, because sometimes once the coach worked with someone, right, he gave him everything, absolutely everything, his entire energy, dedication, and there is nothing left in him for the others. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it doesn't mean that necessarily that it can work again. Maybe it's just one hit wonder. So there are a lot of theories, but to me, you know, it was the right time and the right place and the right coach for Magnus, which made him world champion. Without it, he would not become world champion. Wow. I can almost guarantee you that.
That's interesting. So I guess for the young phenoms that we see right now, like Vincent Kamar from Germany is working with Peter Lecoq, and lately Faruja from Iran has just been unstoppable. So I don't know if they've paired up with players of that stature yet, but I guess it would be good advice.
There is a moment of danger, because when you're young and rapidly progressing, yeah, there is that critical time. There is the time of where even a half a year matters a lot. I mean, these kids are very talented, but you remember a lot of American guys, right? We had like Patrick Wolf and what else, Ilya Gurevich, and we also had some other kids who were extremely talented to play strong chess. Like, I think it was a British Stewart, right? Conquest. There were some other guys who were extremely, extremely talented, very strong potential world championship material. But then they quit chess because, you know, there were other matters that came into moment and made them stop playing chess. And what I was going to say is that there is a certain time period where you have to get that luck of either getting that support just in time and getting that coach just in time. Because if you miss and you do the same thing for the next couple of years and suddenly you're 21 and then suddenly you're 23 and you're still at the same level and then you're no longer hopeful, then you're just an ordinary grandmaster anymore. Yeah.
Yeah.
So these kids, while they're both very talented, right? I played with them a lot on the chess.com. And I absolutely feel how very talented and strong they are. But again, if the kids are missing for next couple of years, they don't get the kind of support they need or the coach they need, that's all they're going to be.
Interesting. Wow. Well, it'll be interesting to track.
And the best thing for them to do is right now is the best thing to do is to learn from the best. And that's why in order to learn from the best, you need to play with the best. And that means you have to qualify for the candidates and you have to play in the candidates. Because if you remember Bobby Fischer, right, he qualified for the candidates, I think, when he was 16 the first time. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, he played all the strongest players in the world by the time when he was 16. Can you imagine?
Yeah.
Obviously, he failed, but he learned so much from that experience. He learned so much that, you know, he failed the first time, and I think he failed the second time also, but he learned from each time, and that got him stronger. When you play the strongest, you learn so much, and that's why he was able to beat them finally, alone, against the entire system, against the against what he always claimed, and which I felt was always true. You know, the grandmasters agreed to draw between each other and try to focus to beat Bobby. Well, it was absolutely a natural thing to do. Yeah. And I'm pretty sure, and everybody knows that was actually true. Just nobody can prove this. But everybody knows that this, in fact, happened. So, again, so that's what you need. Like Magnus, he was playing in the World Cup when he was 13 or 14 the first time, and then next time he was 16, and he qualified further and further closer to the top, and he played the strongest players. When I was playing the World Cup when I won it, right, I became the number 3 in the world, so with a huge experience. So I believe that these kids, if they want to learn and they need to, you know, to grow faster, they need to qualify and play all those top people and learn from that, and only then they have a good chance of challenging the world champion. Hmm. Because right now it seems that there's only Magnus and Corona, nobody else right now.
Yeah.
I don't see anybody else for the next, at least next 2-3 years, I don't see anybody.
Yeah.
I mean, okay? That's my personal opinion.
Okay, well, that's really interesting. Just one or two follow-ups from things you've said. So you mentioned with St. Louis that you were disappointed not to get as much support as some other players. Is that part of the reason for you not having been in the U.S. championships recently? And do you think you'll ever play another one?
Well, I'm sure I'll pre-play. I'm pretty sure I'll play there. No, that support, I was very upset about it. And but it's okay. That lies. That happens. You know, they don't have to support me. But you know, it's just that feeling. I didn't feel great because, you know, I was the candidate and I felt that I still had a chance still to qualify. And if you remember, in 2012, I played in Kazan, right? And I beat Topalov in the first round and I played Gelfand. And the tiebreaker, I lost to him. And later, Gelfand qualified for the World Championship match against Anand, right? So I felt that it could have easily been me. If I had a little bit more support, if I just had a little bit more help, even the financial.
Right.
I remember pretty well that at that year, I was talking to the representative from the US Chess Federation, and I told them that I'm playing candidates, but I have to pay everything. I have to pay my team out of my own pocket. I have to pay my coaches, and I have to pay for the travel and for everything, and I have absolutely no support. So what happened at the closing ceremony, this gentleman, he stood up in front of everybody, and he was very generous. You know, he stood up and he mentioned that I'm playing in the candidates, and that he was asking the people in the room to support me. So the rest of the people from the US Chess Federation, they all managed to donate about $1,000 in total for me. But that's about it. Nobody else, you know. And I think Mr. Rich from St. Louis Club, he also donated something. But, you know, compared to the amount the other guys got, I mean, and even this $1,000, it was great, of course. But, you know, compared to all the expenses that I had, it was nowhere even close to cover at least the expenses.
Yeah,
for travel. So yeah. You know, that made me somewhat upset. But okay, you know, I like to think positively about things, and I realized, of course, you know, that you know probably there was some other factors involved why I wasn't supported. But overall, I was really happy that at least you know chess was supported. That means that there would be other players, other talents, you know, other people who would get the support. And I was very happy when, you know, when we got Caruana, when we got Hikaru, and we got Wesley, and these guys were actually supported, and especially Caruana, I believe. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I don't want to be selfish. I'm pretty happy for these guys. So they got support, and as we saw, Caruana really got really close in the World Championship match, and he had his shot, and he learned his lesson that it's no longer just about theory. It's also about sport. It's also about learning how to play well, not just in the classical game, but it's also about learning how to play in the tiebreakers, right, which were the key.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one of the key moments. So hopefully he learned his lesson. He would improve his game in other types of chess, which is critical.
Yeah.
And that works. But basically, I moved to Russia because I met my wonderful wife at that time. And, you know, in my life, you know, chess, of course, is important, but the people that are close to me, they were much more important to me than chess always. And ever since I got free from my parents' influence, you know, I valued each moment, each person that came close to me. And my wife was extremely important. She was very helpful. And I thank you very much for helping me to finish this book project. You know, without her, I would never finish it. You know, to be honest, I would start, but I would postpone it. And with her help, I managed last year, and especially with the help of the editors, who were extremely supportive. I thank Romain, and I thank Dan from the Thinkers Publishing, and I was able to finish this book, you know, which is a huge achievement.
Yeah, it really is. And we're looking forward to the second volume. So, and while we wait for that, are you going to be doing any more streaming or going to be on hiatus from that? What do you think, Gata?
Well, I was doing a lot of streaming on the chess.com because I feel that the chess as it is during the last couple of decades, even this time, especially under the recent changes in FIDE, you know, chess remained the same while everything in the world moves, right? If you guys remember, the esports, they just started like 4 or 5 years ago, and there's been a huge momentum, and there is a lot of sponsorship, and there is a lot of great things in the esports. A lot of people are very enthusiastic about it. And when I found about that, I was very, very concerned because chess could have been that esport, and they could have been making waves and making all those people and everybody. Right now in the world, right, there is only like top 20 players who can make a living by playing professional chess, right? In the esports, you have a lot of people who earn decent salaries, right? And that's what I said. You know, esports today is what chess should have been like a couple of decades ago. So a lot of people, I think, not actually a lot of people, but at least people on chess.com, I think I made some posts on the Facebook, I made some posts on the Twitter to that effect that, you know, chess is a perfect esport, actually, because, you know, it can be played online on the internet, could be played anywhere. from your phone, from your computer. You know, you can have teams, you can have a lot of excitement, people from all over the world, you know, joined and playing the same game, like, right, we all love chess. So, and, you know, chess.com, they started to create this pro chess league. It's run by Greg Shahari, and they were separate before, but then they joined forces, so all those events now run on chess.com. They also been running some Title Tuesday events for, I don't know, a few years now, I think, yeah? And just 2 years ago, they started playing, creating those Arena King tournaments, you know, some cash prizes for the players, so I've been playing those events. And that's where I've been, because when you play online, you have to stream to prove that you are who you are.
Yeah.
You know, everybody knows about the cheating cases, right? And chess, right, especially when you're in your face online. And every tournament, there's still some cheaters, you know. And that's a big, of course, thing for chess, so, which is a huge, biggest danger. I mean, the well-known cases of accusations of cheating in chess, even in tournament chess, in live chess, yeah? But here we're talking about internet, where you can hide behind your screen. You can be anybody. You can have friends sitting next to you, you know, giving you moves, etc. So there are a lot of ways to cheat. And a lot of people are caught. Even some of the grandmasters have been banned and caught. You know, they just, their names were not publicized, you know, to spare them from all this scathing attack by the chess community. But FIDE needs to come up with some really strong guidelines and rules, because cheating is really unacceptable. I believe that it should be like in cycling, right? If you've caught cheating, all your titles should be immediately taken from you, yeah, right? Because this it's not just you steal money, which is basically you steal somebody else's livelihood, right? Chess players don't make a lot of money. So any money that you steal, it could be incredibly important to the other person. So that is one of the things that I really feel strongly about, and I feel that International Federation is not doing much to address this concern, but it should be addressed. It should have been addressed at least 5 years ago, and they created some commissions, but still there are not, you know, clear rules, and it's still not being addressed. So
do you think there's a lot of cheating in tournament chess right now? Like, I definitely agree with you about online, and it's unfortunately an uphill battle, although hopefully the engine detection can at least stem the tide. But in live, do you think that even at the top levels, there's cheating taking place?
Well, I'm not sure about the top level, because top level grandmasters, why would they risk cheating? Because, I mean, there are some special cases, but it's more of a concern at the club level these days, right?
Yeah.
In the open tournaments.
Yeah.
But of course, the top level chess, they have their own, you know, as I said, cases which are also well known. They cannot be proven, so we're not going to talk about these guys. But it's been a concern, and the lack of concern from International Federation is also another cause of concern, which is funny, but it's ironic, but it is true. So cheating in chess is the topic, and of course now we can, that is related to the next question, because what is the alternative? And the alternative is the Fischer random chess.
Yeah. Right?
That is the subject, again, that I feel very strongly about it. And I'm really happy that earlier this year, FIDE made a post, a short, very short post, and I hope they don't change their mind. They actually want to start to invest in the Fischer random chess, and they want to create the first Fischer random chess world championship this year.
That would be great, yeah.
So that's, again, everybody has their own opinion, but it will be nice to have also another tournament. You can have classical chess, but why can't you have a Fischer random chess? I mean, I remember many years ago in Mainz, if you remember, there were these great Fischer random open tournaments and rapid events. There were like unofficial world championships. A lot of top players came. And it was so nice, you know, when you have no theory, when you can just play chess and just enjoy chess, mm-hmm, and create something. Like, for example, I beat Mamedyarov like in five moves because he blundered his knight, you know, he was playing white and he blundered his knight like after five moves of no theory, like completely weird position. Right. It was a very, very tricky geometry, like a grandmaster, like losing a knight. Can you believe it?
Right.
No, it doesn't happen normal chess. Anyway.
Cool.
These are my thoughts and I hope you guys, you know.
Okay. Well, Gata, I just want to thank you for being so generous with your time. This has been incredible. And listeners, buy the book. You support this man. I mean, he's devoted his life to chess, and this book is well worth it. I wouldn't steer you guys wrong. So I'll post everywhere to get it. You guys can follow him on Twitch. Is there anywhere else where people should go to keep up with you, Gata?
I'm also on Facebook. And okay. So that is nice. Yeah. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you so much. This has been an honor and a privilege and quite enjoyable on top of that.
Thank you. Good night, everybody.
Thanks to everyone who makes Perpetual Chess possible. Of course, that includes Matthew Passy, my producer, and Geert Vandervelt for supplying the intro music. I also want to thank everyone who helps spread the word about the show. That includes people who tell their friends, tweet about it, share on Facebook. Apparently, Instagram is a thing. Every little bit helps grow the show. But most of all, I want to thank people who support the show financially. I've said this before, but Perpetual Chess is my most gratifying but least paying work. If everyone who listened to the show were able to kick in $1 a month, it would be my best paying and most gratifying work. So I want to thank those who are able to provide financial support. That includes extra special thanks to Chessable.com, Quality Chess Books, the Capital City Chess Club, Dan O'Hanlon, Greg Shahadi, John Jernigan, and Todd Bryant. And I also want to thank all of my Patreon and PayPal perpetual partners. Here comes the list. You guys ready? Here we go. Ace Vallega, Adam Ralph of ChessEngland.com, Adam Vrancourge, Adrian Gutierrez, Alex Pejas, Benjamin Handelman, BetterChessTraining.com, Bill Moran, Brett Howard Lynn, Brian Mullis, I am Carlos Perdomo of ChessAtlanta.com, Chad Hilton, Chad Oliver, Chris Balcom, Chris Flanagan, Chris Wainscott, Christopher Baumgartner, Christopher Chabri, Christopher Wood. Good job, Christophers. I am Christoph Zalicki, a.k.a. Chess Explained, Coach J's Chess Academy, Daniel Gell, Daniel Ginsburg, Daniel Lucas, Daniel Naylor, Daniel Schaefer. Good job, Daniels. Dave Saylor, David Cramley of Chessable.com, Dwayne Edmonds, Ethan Smith. I am Elect Donnie Ariel Esquire, Fox Valley Chess Club of Aurora, Illinois, Frank Tortoris, M.D., Gary Andrews, Gary Lewis, Geert Vandervelt, Gerard Barta, Giovanni Russo, Harish Srinivasan, GM Jakob Ogar of Quality Chess Publishing, James Bonastia, Jason Willem, Jeff Anderson, Jeffrey Martello, John Fernandez, John Fartentain, John Hartman, Jen Shahadi, Jens Green, Jerry Wells, John Thompson, GM Josh Friedel, Kari Christensen, WGM Katerina Nemsova, Kelly Palmer, I am Kostya Kavrutsky, Krishna Gopala Krishnan, Laura Belyavsky, Lucio Casada Silva, Matthew Passy, Martin Habich, Matthew Tedesco of SeattleChessMeetup.org, the mysterious Moonmaster 9000, Mr. Michael Shahadi, Nate Salon, Nathan Webster, GM Pascal Charbonneau, Passy Passanen, Paul Bain, Paul Clarkson, Paul Sweeney, Paulo Santana, Peter Lux, Peter Merrifield, Randy Temple, Ricky Grijalva, Rob Lazorchek of DiplomatChess.com, Robert Steiner, Ryan Berg, Scott Daugherty, Scott McKinnon, Steiner Lima, the Law Office of Stuart Katz, WGM Tatyav Abrahamian, Thomas Casper, Thomas Stanek, Thomas Tachenko, Tim Brennan of TacticsTime.com. His book is coming to Chessable. Tim Seymour, Timothy Ha, Tony Rotella, Tyron Price, Victor Vrancourt, FM Zhao Cheng of Chess1000.com, and Zhivko Stoyana. Thank you, everyone, and I will catch you all next week.
Podcast Network.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.